got a little wet. Okay, I'm going. All right, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the December 15th, 2015 regular board meeting of San Luis Coastal Unified School District. The board met in closed session and discussed a personnel matter and conference with labor negotiators, and I will report out personnel matter at this time. During closed session this evening, the board considered a resignation agreement with a classified employee employed in the position of secretary clerk. Trustee Chris Unger moved to accept the resignation agreement with the classified employee. Trustee Catherine Eisendrath Rogers seconded the motion to approve the resignation agreement. The motion was passed by the following vote. Dr. Eisendrath Rogers, yes. Walter Millar, who attended via telephone, yes. Marilyn Roger, yes. Ellen Sheffer, yes. Chris Unger, yes, with Mr. Buckman and Mr. Quesenberry abstaining. The employee will remain in paid status through the end of February 2016. All right, moving on to open session. Item 4.01, do we have consensus on the order of business?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Then we have some minutes to approve. So just going down the line here, approval of the minutes from November 13, 2015. Any corrections, changes, revisions, comments?
I move approval.
Thank you. A second?
I'll second.
All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Approval of minutes from November 17th, 2015. Any comments, changes?
I move approval of the minutes of November 17th.
Thank you.
And I'll second.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. And last but not least, approval of the minutes of November 20th, 2015. Boy, we met a lot in a week. Thank you. Second? Anybody?
Second.
Mr. Quesenberry, thank you. Any further discussion? All right. Thank you. So next is our student representatives to the board, and I would like to, before we...
Vote?
Yes. Oh, vote. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Thank you. So as we move on to our student representatives to the board, this has been an exciting week for some students who are active one way or another with the Board of Trustees, one of whom is sitting at this table. Bella, congratulations on your admission to Harvard. So excited. And Dr. Eisendrath Rogers, please extend your warm congratulations to your son, Sam, on his admission into Harvard. So, wonderful things happening in our district. I know this is, we've got many, many students at both high schools on tenterhooks waiting to hear either about early admission and then those who are waiting until March or so to hear. So, our thoughts are with them all, and go Pirates and Tigers. So at this time, we will have our student representatives. And Bella, you want to begin?
Sure.
Thank you for that. I am very excited. I found out in my fifth period class and ran out crying and stood in the rain and called my mom. So it was a very exciting couple of weeks. So, yes, it was very, very exciting. And that's been what's been going on for a lot of seniors, actually, who applied early to different schools. Today was the admission date for Yale. So there was a student in my class, Sam Powell, who found out during fifth period, and he said, yay! There were no tears, but it was also a great reaction. So our fifth period teacher has been a little, we've been distracting him a little bit recently, but it's been really fun. So other things going on at Slo High, we have our winter sports going up, which are basketball, soccer, water polo, and wrestling, and our Tigers have been doing exceedingly well in all of those sports. We have our Fall Sports Award Banquet, which is tomorrow, where we celebrate all the fall sports and all the athletes in those areas. Also, our talented band members, they have recently had a concert at the Madonna Inn, and they provided a free holiday concert to the public that was held last week as well. So they've been very involved in the community, as well as our choir, who's been performing all over the community, also spreading some sort of holiday cheer all around with their talented voices. Also, our ASB had an overnight retreat. Mr. Johnson and Ms. Bedall, we had our winter retreat over at the school, actually. We slept over in the library and had a lot of bonding activities and a lot of leadership growth, and it was actually amazing. It's sort of the time in the year where normally we traditionally have sort of a lull in our ASB, and we thought it'd be a really good way to reinvigorate our members and really get everyone excited for the rest of the year, and it worked incredibly well. So that was a really great event for us, and we're really excited for what we can do with that bonding that we got out of that weekend. Also, we had an open mic, so we brought Taqueria Santa Cruz onto campus, and we sold 150 burritos to students and filled up an entire side of the bleachers, and we got to showcase the talent on campus for our different musicians and stand-up comedians, actually, that showed for our lunchtime open mic. So that was a really fun event. Also, we have a sweater and school supplies drive that is going on right now, and those items are going to be donated to the Children's Resource Network for those students and other children who don't necessarily have the ability to have those kinds of resources, so that's what we're doing right now. And on Friday, we are having an ugly sweater competition for who can wear the ugliest sweater to school, and I've made multiple trips to Goodwill, so I think you'll expect to see me in the top three. That's all I have to report. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So our last week was our first annual week of winter, and so each day we have a new activity planned for the students to do or to participate in. So Monday was the scarf day, so a bunch of students would wear scarves. And then Tuesday was our free hot cocoa if you brought your own mug, and a lot of people brought their own mugs, which is pretty sweet. We ran out of hot cocoa pretty quick. And then Wednesday was an ugly sweater day, and we saw a lot of ugly sweaters and pretty nice sweaters, too. Thursday we had a... We played a secret donut game, and we would get powdered donuts and try and fish them into our fellow students' mouths, which was pretty messy, but it was fun. And then Friday was our funny hat day, and we saw a lot of funny hats, but it wasn't really holiday-oriented, but it was still pretty fun. Our Mora Bay basketball team won their tournament in Napa last week, and our girls' water polo team took first in their tournament, and our boys' wrestling team won their dual meet against Slo. Also, our wrestling team has 50 kids this year, which is a substantial amount of kids. Also, we made T-shirts that say game day on them. So usually around once a season, for each sport, we try to get as many kids as we can to go to one particular game that we hope we do well in, and just support all the players. So we have shirts for that. We'll give deals to people who buy the shirts, and so they go to more games, which is pretty sweet. We don't have anything planned this week because we have finals starting Wednesday, And the Morro Bay High School Choir is performing at the PAC tonight, and the band performs tomorrow night. Also, this weekend, we have our first Morro Bay Surf Club contest down in Summers Beach, which is exciting. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. I would like to also give a shout-out to our prior San Luis Obispo High School Board Representative, who is here tonight, back from Oregon, John O. Roberts. Thank you for coming to visit. We love seeing you. I bet you really wish you were up here getting to talk, don't you? Okay. So thank you so much. And understanding Morro Bay has finals starting. And Bella, I'm sure you have things to do. Should you wish, you are welcome to stay or carry on with your evening, whatever you need to do. But thank you so much for your reports. All right, next we have our Citizens Bond Oversight Committee report. Mr. Pinkerton.
Yeah, so as the board knows, we have a Citizens Bond Oversight Committee. So as part of the proposition and bond measure passage, a group of citizens has been selected by the board. And we have met three times now over the course of the year to go over finances, kind of expenditures, what's happening with Measure D, those types of things. So we have Dr. Jim Stanfill here tonight. He is the vice president of our CBOC group. And so you'll see the letter, Kim, if you can pull that up for me, the 12-15-15. So one of the key purposes of the Citizens Bond Oversight Committee is to ensure that every Measure D dollar is spent on projects as outlined by the ballot measure. And so at our last meeting, we went over both the financial as well as performance audits. And so basically our auditor comes in and looks at both from the financial side and then actually breaks open the ballot language and ensures that all of the things that we're doing correspond with what the voters have done. And so Mr. Stanfill is just here to answer any questions the board may have in terms of the CBOC meeting itself. And I think he has a couple of things to say. Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to say that it's a pleasure to serve on this board and to be supported by Ryan, who does an outstanding job of keeping us informed of all that's going on. Appreciate Ron's input, and Anthony, is it? Others who just really, overwhelm us with data. But it's all necessary, and the group that you've identified, names who appear up there, are quality people. I'm impressed and impressive to be a part of this group, and so I think we're on the right track.
Thank you.
Any questions or comments?
Thank you for your service.
My pleasure.
Yeah,
all right.
Anything else? Thank you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
All right.
We're good.
I'm out here.
Thank you.
All right, moving on to item 6.01. Now is the time for our annual board organization. So it's my understanding that the first thing we do is to elect a president for the 2016 calendar year. Actually, beginning tonight, the new president will take over after we conclude this item. So I would entertain a motion. Mr. Pleasantberry?
Well, first I just want to have a point of maybe clarification. So typically we do the president and then the board clerk. And we don't usually do them together.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Correct.
It has to be
two separate
motions. Okay.
Yeah.
So, Chris, you had your line on. I'm going to let Chris take the floor. If that's all right.
Mr. Unger.
I'd like to nominate Marilyn Roger for president of our board.
And I'll second that.
All right. Any discussion? First, I will ask Mrs. Roger, would you accept this nomination?
I would.
Thank you. Any discussion at this time? Then we'll have a vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Congratulations. 6-0. Mr. Millar, not present. this evening. And next, I'm going to take it upon myself as my last formal action here as president to nominate a clerk, and that would be Dr. Catherine Eisendrath Rogers.
I will second that.
Would you so choose to serve?
Yeah.
Thank you. All right. Any further comments? I'll take a vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Welcome. And I would at this time just like to indicate that it has been a pleasure and an honor to serve as board president this year. I have greatly appreciated the team of Marilyn Roger with me. We have collaborated and kept one another apprised, not always in agreement, but with good conversation and discussion. And I also very much appreciate the work of the staff in being available and answering questions, and Dr. Prater's meeting with us and keeping us informed throughout the year. So thank you all. Dr. Prater.
Yeah, before we move on and change and move chairs, I would like to acknowledge Mrs. Sheffer for her year of actually, it's been 2 years, a year of being clerk and a year of presidency. And so there's two things that I want to acknowledge. One is Mrs. Sheffer has requested a donation on her behalf to our school libraries. And so, and I want to make sure, so Mrs. Holmes, could you go to 6.02? So I could, 6.02, there we go. So there are two books. The district librarian has selected The War That Saved My Life by Kimberly Brubaker Bradley for C.L. Smith, for which Mrs. Sheffer's children attended, and The Young Activist Guide to Building a Green Movement and Changing the World by Sharon J. Smith for Pack Beach. Ms. Smith is a local author, and the book was highlighted in local historian Don Krieger's column. So here's a copy of the book to C.L. Smith's library, and on the it's called The War That Saved My Life. And this was chosen by Mrs. Haup, who's our district librarian, who has some, I think, keen insights. And I was glancing through the inside cover of this book, and I'm just going to read to you the last sort of paragraph describing the book. It says, "Set during one of the most explosive periods in world history, this amazing story is equal parts adventure and a moving tale of family, identity, and the fire of self-worth that can, when fed, burn brightly in all of us." I've come to know Mrs. Sheffer for the last couple of years. Actually, this is my sixth year of knowing you, but so intimately as a clerk and president. And that aptly describes who I think you are, which is someone who does care deeply about the world around you, and you are up for an adventure. And you've been on a few of those recently. I want to take a moment and acknowledge outgoing President Mrs. Sheffer. For the past 2 years, she served in the capacity of clerk and president, working closely with me on a weekly basis. She has kept her focus on the well-being of students and employees in our district. Her commitment went beyond the workday and well into the weekends as she studied the intricacies and inner workings of our district. Throughout this time, Ellen has revealed a strong character and devotion to K-12 public education. She is truly all about kids, especially those who don't have a strong voice or an advocate. We have grown to admire you, Mrs. Sheffer, as you fought through your personal health struggles while never missing a meeting, a deadline, or a study session. This required tremendous courage and self-sacrifice. You have worked hard despite these challenges, and we all deeply appreciate what you've done to help move our district forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. That's all very embarrassing. Thank you. Thank you. We will. Okay, we're going to So we will we're going to play musical chairs for a moment, and
it's been some years since I've done this, so bear with me while I reorient myself. The next item of business is adoption, item 6.03, adoption of the 2016 board meeting calendar.
I move adoption of the board meeting calendar.
I'll second.
Moved by...
I have some discussion.
Okay. Mr. Unger?
March 15th, which is our second meeting in March, is also the CSBA legislative day when we hope to get as many board members as possible to Sacramento to lobby for issues that are important for education. I know that I'm going to be attending it, and I would ask anybody else on this board to attend if they possibly could. That said, I will not be able to be at the meeting of the 15th. So I would like to ask that we move the meeting of the 15th to the 22nd, with the board's permission and with the permission of the administration. So I would ask that as an amendment to the motion.
Is there any discussion, Mr. Quisenberry?
Well, as the maker of the motion, I accept your amendment.
Okay. So I guess we vote. We have to vote on the amendment.
Okay, so all in favor of the 2016 calendar as amended? Ayes?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
Nays?
I want to thank everybody.
Okay, 6-0.
March
16th. Item 6.04, appoint board members to committees and liaison posts. Who is presenting on this item?
Anybody?
Dr. Prater.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
That's okay.
So each organizational meeting, each year, we have committees that our board trustees have volunteered for and represent. And each year, we bring these back. And those committees are the Central Coast Schools Financing Authority, currently held by Mr. Millar. We have the SLO County School Boards Association, presently held by Mr. Quisenberry. We have the interest-based bargaining liaisons, presently held by Dr. Catherine Eisendreth Rogers for representing CSEA and Mrs. Marilyn Roger for SEIU. We have the Tri-County Education Coalition, presently held by Mr. Buckman. And then we also, it's an additional agenda item on 6.05, where we have a CSBA delegate assembly nomination, currently held by Mr. Buckman, who, so that's 6.05. So the purpose of this particular agenda item is to seek new representation or existing representation.
Okay, well, why don't we take them one at a time? Which was the first? Was the financing authority, currently held by
Mr. Millar? The Central California Schools Financing Authority. I need my glasses.
And is that the
That's the oil wells on Price Canyon
with Lucia Mar.
With Lucia Mar. Yeah, and it's a very easy assignment. The meetings last potentially as long as 5 minutes, and they're held, I believe, quarterly. So it's a great assignment.
Okay, so as you've just told us, given the inherent complexity, I would nominate Mr. Millar to continue in that position. And we have a second from Dr. Eisendreth Rogers. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? That passes 6-0. And then the next was...
is the SLO County School Boards Association, held currently by Mr. Quesenberry.
Mr. Quesenberry.
I am interested in continuing. The one meeting they held this year was deferred, delayed, and then canceled, and we voted by mail. So that's right up my alley. Thank you.
Okay. Well, if no one else is expressing an interest, a particular interest in this assignment, then, and Mr. Quesenberry has indicated he's willing to continue, will someone make a nomination for him to continue?
I'll move the nomination.
I'll second.
Motion by Mr. Unger and a second by Mrs. Sheffer. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That passes 6-0.
So the next committee is the interest-based bargaining liaisons representing CSEA, which is currently held by Dr. Catherine Eisendreth Rogers, and SEIU, which is held by Mrs. Roger. Two appointments.
Okay. Dr. Eisendreth Rogers, do you have interest in continuing in that capacity?
I am interested. However, I feel like I remember
someone else on the board in the past asking, was it you, Mrs. Sheffer, who had an interest in the interest-based bargaining?
You know, my primary interest was just that if people are interested in other positions, that they have an opportunity to serve. So
right. Okay.
If you're interested in continuing, it's my understanding that the people in those units like to have a sense of continuity, so I would defer if you're interested in continuing to go ahead and do that, that you should
okay.
continue.
Yes, I am interested in continuing if that doesn't bump anyone else from that opportunity.
Any other comments? Expressions of interest? Then I'll nominate Dr. Eisendreth Rogers to continue in that CSEA liaison capacity.
I'll second that.
So a motion by myself and a second by Mr. Buckman. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That passes 6-0.
And then the next one is the SEIU representation, for which is currently held by Ms. Roger.
Which I have done for some time, and I enjoy and would like to continue doing. However, as Dr. Eisendreth Rogers said, if anyone else on the board is interested in that position, then I will give over to the interest of one of my colleagues. Well, seeing no interest and feeling no hidden resentment, I'll look for a nomination.
I move your nomination.
Thank you, Mr. Quesenberry.
I'll second that.
So we have a motion by Mr. Quesenberry, second by Mr. Unger. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Passes 6-0. And a note to myself that I have a meeting from 12 to 2 tomorrow. Thought perhaps I'd be passing that note on to someone else.
And then the final committee for this agenda item is the Tri-County Education Coalition, presently held by Mr. Buckman.
Okay. Mr. Buckman, do you have an interest in continuing in that capacity?
Yeah, I'd like to. I'm the incoming president, so I'd sort of like to fulfill that obligation.
Okay.
I'll nominate Mark Buckman for our representative as to the Tri-Counties Education Coalition.
And I'll second it.
Okay. So a motion by Mr. Unger, second by Mr. Quesenberry. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That passes 6-0. So we've completed item 6.04. 6.05 is nomination to CSBA Delegate Assembly Region 9C.
So this position is for the California School Board's governance team, where it's a statewide delegation of representatives who are trustees on school boards belonging to CSBA. San Luis Obispo County is in Region 9C, represented by two delegates with staggered terms. Tammy Gunther from Atascadero was reelected in 2013, and Mr. Buckman in San Luis Coastal holds the other seat, which is up for election next year. Mr. Buckman has indicated an interest in running for another term, and this is the board's under the board's purview.
I had the opportunity to see Mr. Buckman at work at CSBA, and he was doing an excellent job, and I'd like to nominate him to continue if he's interested.
And I'll second that. I would like to make a correction to the item, though, and that is that Ms. Gunther is actually the CSBA Region 9 director, and that Vicki Maher of LUCMR is the other delegate for Region 9C.
Oh, good correction. Okay, so we have a nomination by Dr. Eisendrath Rogers, a second by Mr. Unger. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Abstained.
Oh, you've abstained? Okay, so we have five ayes, one abstention, and one absent. Okay, congratulations. Now, the next item is 7.01, correspondence. At the time we received the agenda, no correspondence had been received. Have any individual board members received correspondence they'd like to share? Okay, 7.02 is public comment. And I believe we have one.
We have a request by Heidi Harmon to speak.
I think I can speak briefly about that. Ms. Harmon actually came to speak in opposition of the Phillips 66 train extension and rail spur, and she didn't realize that we over the summer issued or wrote a letter of concern to the Board of Supervisors expressing our concerns over the expansion. And she wasn't aware of that. We showed her the correspondence, and I believe that satisfied her need to share her concerns.
Okay. Is there anyone else present that would like to address the board but did not fill in a request? This would be your opportunity to speak now. Seeing no one then, we'll close public comment and move on to item 8.01, business and budget update. Mr. Pinkerton.
Yeah, so on a good note, the continually through school services, you know, we receive monthly updates about the economy, what the LAO is feeling, and so it definitely looks like that, you know, for another year, we're seeing really positive really positive findings in terms of the budget. And so all expectations are is that, you know, next year is going to be another really positive budgetary cycle for everyone. So it'll be really interesting to see, again, how the governor comes out in terms of ongoing revenues, and then for us as a basic aid school district, the impact of potential one-time funds. So hopefully in the governor's budget that will come forward, we'll know more. But a positive economy is, of course, a positive thing for us. As we know, in terms of property taxes, those types of things assist us as well. Kudos to Andy Sharp. Put in another grant for another bus and was awarded another bus for San Luis Coastal in terms of basically replacing one of our older buses. And so it's one of our larger buses. And so, again, kudos to Andy for seeking that out, for, you know, finding the grant opportunities, and for the Air Pollution Control District for awarding us that bus. And so that information will be coming through with the board, and I'll update you as well. And then there was a really interesting CSBA update about bond ratings. And so I don't know if you saw that today, but it came out. But it was really interesting that as Dr. Prater and I went forward with our first series of bonds, and it was, as well as our district financial shape and our seven-year budget and our reserves and those types of things, we were kind of, it was kind of weird why we didn't get a AAA rating and those types of things. And so a lot of that has to do with the way they view school bonds and getting paid back and so on. But in the CSBA article, there was a district in San Diego that had basically kind of challenged that notion and that assumption and was actually able to receive a AAA rating from Finch. And so as soon as I got it, I forwarded it right on to John Isom and said, hey, what's going on here? And so John said this was kind of a challenge that moved through, and so it'll be interesting to see how this plays out before our next potential bond sale in the future. So I'll keep the board updated on that. But it was just an interesting article in CSBA.
If I can, I think either in the same article, Ryan, or in another one, one district has already been promoted to a AAA rating.
Based that was on the San Diego district, yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. Yep.
Any other comments? Okay.
I would just like to, I think that Annie, if we were keeping tally at this time, my guess would be that Annie Sharp has single-handedly saved our district $1 million.
More.
And
is this number seven bus?
Yeah, so please express our huge gratitude. I think I can speak for all of the board on this. Her efforts are amazing and so appreciated. We please express that to her. Thank you. Anthony, you can do it too. The more she hears it, the better. Thanks.
Okay. If there's no additional comment, then we'll move on to item 8.02, Educational Services Update.
Thank you. Federal Senate Bill 1177, which is being called the Every Student Succeeds Act, or ESSA, is out of conference committee. I don't know if it's been voted on yet, but by the end of the week, both houses of Congress are expected to wrap this up and get it on the president's desk. It will be signed into law, we're certain, before this board meets again. It is a large and comprehensive law that pretty much dismantles most of the provisions of the No Child Left Behind Act. It has bipartisan support. Should I say that again? It's a pretty remarkable thing to have bipartisan support on anything these days. And the overarching goal is to shift accountability and control for student achievement away from the feds and bringing it back to the states. I mean, that's probably the easiest way to summarize it. There are a lot of moving parts. It will affect every one of the federal title programs. So Title I through Title IX, there will be some effect by this law. And so a few highlights. Title I, which of course has the biggest impact for us, is expected to be fully funded. In fact, the law actually reads increases over the next 4 years. But Congress may be looking at new measures of analyzing and quantifying poverty, so there could be changes in how those funds are allocated. The Act calls for a congressional study actually to happen over the next year, so we will see how that impacts us. Adequate yearly progress is eliminated. Instead, states are to apply and measure academic standards themselves. There is no reporting to the Secretary of Education at the federal level. Common core standards are not mandated federally, which is not a change. I mean, they're not mandated at this point, so that remains a state decision. The bill will still require testing for all students in English language arts and mathematics in grades 3 through 8 and at least 1 year in high school, which is the practice in California. We are required to have an accountability plan, which, of course, the state of California already mandates with the LCAP. And I think it's interesting to note that each LEA must also, in the new law, which was not part of NCLB, report on how it is supporting early childhood education. It's a big component of the early of the Every Student Succeeds Act, which so we're certainly on the forefront of that. There may be some federal grants that are separate from Head Start that will help with preschool programs. States will develop criteria for underperforming schools, so there is certainly the expectation that schools must continue to show progress, even though that AYP is not reported at the federal level. There will still be provisions for parents to request transfers out of schools that are identified as underperforming, but that's a state determination. The bill will prohibit the feds from having any oversight as to educator qualifications. So no more of the highly qualified educator requirements, which was one of the most difficult things we had to deal with NCLB. So overall, we see this as a very positive move. There are a lot of bureaucratic elements of NCLB, as well-meaning as that law has been over the years. California is a lead state in terms of emphasizing local accountability already, so we will have an easy time, I think, adjusting to this. But over the next year or so, as the law gets put into effect, we'll see what the real impacts are, and we'll keep the board posted as this becomes the new law in the new year. Just another note, besides our choir for Morro Bay High School meeting, as the board's meeting right now, are performing. Also, I think it was in the newspaper in the last day or two. Mr. Townsend's class at Laguna Middle School has an interesting evening going on tonight, where, as a seventh grade project, his students were charged with coming up with ideas, solutions, concepts to deal with the emerging refugee crisis situations all over the world. And so those projects are being presented publicly tonight. So I'll be very curious to see how that goes. It's really a great opportunity for kids to apply skills in a real practical way. And that's what I have for you.
Mr. Buckman.
Hi. I think Rick is either being shy on behalf of the board or but I think it's really interesting to note that in this new ESEA renewal, there's a tremendous amount, there's attention paid by this bipartisan piece of legislation to school boards and the value of school boards, and it's a bipartisan support for the work that we do. And I just want to mention that, because sometimes I hear, well, what are you guys doing? Why are you needed? And so here's it coming down from the federal level. It was nice to hear that, too, and just wanted to tack that onto your great report.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, then we'll move on to item 8.03, the Measure D update.
It's ramping up. It's all coming together, Measure D. So we, just so the board knows, we're going to be putting signage up at both Morro Bay High School and SLO High School over the winter break. Three signs, so a couple of key signs just to kind of talk about projects and plans and things at both sites, and then one where the pool is going to go at Morro Bay High School, because that's nearing construction, getting out of DSA very soon. And then we'll also have a couple at San Luis Obispo High School. Anthony and I and Ron have begun site meetings. So now that the board has moved forward and with the approval process, now it's really rubber hits the road time. So it's what are we going to do when construction's happening, and the plans and the look, and how is this all moving forward. So we've set up individual meetings, also another meeting with Dr. Prater and Mr. Robinette, to just talk about how the district can support the sites through this process. And what their needs are, and with teachers and planning, and just really doing whatever we can up front to assist and make it as easy as possible. So we did that again both with Morobe High School as well as San Luis Obispo High School recently. We have also been meeting with RRM to discuss the project at Bellevue Santa Fe. Because that directly relates to temporary housing at San Luis Obispo High School. We have a meeting coming up to discuss the construction at Scale Smith as well as Bishop's Peak elementary sites. And so I think as those come along, we'll be putting signage up at those sites as well. I'll be working with Mandy Dawson to update our Measure D website over the next couple of days so that all of these things that we've been doing, there's a place that the public can go to see and kind of check in on where we're at. I think that's very important. Kind of the next study session, what I would propose to the board, if it's okay, is that Mr. Holcomb and Mr. Palazzo kind of walk the board through the design, bid, build process. So what's a qualification? What's the DIR? How's that work? And kind of just through that whole process of getting bids and what it's like to be a contractor, what it's like to be an architect in that process, and kind of just walk the board through. So that's our January study session coming up. And so that'll be on the, you know, kind of right prior to us really moving forward, hopefully beginning of March, with the bidding documents and things for the pool at Morobe High School. So I think it'll be a good timing to kind of lay that out. And we have an RFQ that we'll be bringing to the board tonight as part of the process of the design build process. But Mr. Palazzo, Mr. Holcomb, and myself have also kind of laid out all the board meetings. So as we move board meetings, as we do things, we're all predicated now kind of on approvals when we need to get things done so that we can really begin full force, I would say, over the course of this summer in getting a lot of the projects underway and moving forward. So it's exciting, very exciting.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Holcomb, did you have anything you'd like to add to the Measure D report?
I think that was fairly complete.
Okay. Seeing no questions, then we'll move on to item 9. Oh, Mr. Unger.
Have we set a date for the January study session yet?
I think it's on the calendar.
The 22nd.
Okay, thank you.
It's January 22nd.
Thank you.
Okay. We have, pardon me, several public hearings. Item 9.01 is the Personnel Commission appointment.
All of these items, so the Personnel Commission, as you know, you made the recommendation that will appear later on the agenda that Julia Jones joins the Personnel Commission, and we have our first meeting tomorrow. And so this is an opportunity for the public to weigh in on this appointment that appears later in the agenda.
Thank you. So we will open this up to the public. This is a public hearing on our Personnel Commission appointment. Is there any public input? Seeing none, we'll close the hearing and move to item 9.02, the board's interest for CSEA negotiations. Again, Mrs. Newland.
Yes, the next three items are all interests for negotiations and an opportunity for the public to weigh in before they appear later on the agenda.
Okay, thank you. We will then open the public hearing. If anyone wishes to comment on the board's interest for CSEA negotiations, this is your opportunity. Seeing none, we will close the public hearing. Item 9.03 is CSEA's interests for negotiations. We'll open the public hearing. Is there any public comment on this matter? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing and move to item 9.04, San Luis Coastal Teachers Association's interests for negotiations. We'll open the public hearing. This is your opportunity to speak to this item. Seeing no one, we'll close the public hearing and move to item 9.05, the California Department of Education waiver of certification requirement for educational interpreter.
So we have hired Catherine Robiscotti on a provisional appointment
into a position as an ASL educational interpreter. And she does not have the requirements that are required by law. These are really stiff requirements that have gone into place about 3 to 5 years ago. You have to be certified by the National Registry of Interpreters for the Deaf. It's called RID or RID certification. And if you don't have RID certification, you have to pass an educational interpreter's exam at a score of 4.0 or above. And Kathy graduated in 1993 from the University of New Mexico with a Bachelor's of Science degree in sign language interpretation, and this and in the linguistics department. But this was prior to any of these certifications or assessments. And she has experience interpreting at Cuesta College since 1999. So it's really not an issue of her qualifications. It's the issue that she doesn't actually have the certification. So we've hired her on a provisional basis into this position, and her provisional appointment will continue until March 6th, and she has taken the performance assessment that's given by the Boys Town National Research Hospital, and they have given us the recommendation that she is okay to hire, with a recommendation that she complete the educational interpreter's performance assessment within the next year. But in order for us to apply for a waiver on her behalf, we are required to get participation from both the collective bargaining unit, and which would be CSEA in this case, and a parent group at C.L. Smith, and we have brought it up to them and have minutes of that. It's been posted in the newspaper as required by the law, and the last step is to have a public hearing here tonight.
Thank you. Well, then we'll open the public hearing in the matter of the CDE waiver of certification requirement for educational interpreter. Is there any member of the public who would like to speak to this issue? This is your opportunity. Seeing none, then we'll close the public hearing. And thank you, Mrs. Newland. And move on to resolutions. Mrs. Lang.
Good evening.
Good evening.
This is the time of year when we present our first interim report. The resolution states that this is a positive certification, which means we can meet our financial obligations in this fiscal year and the two subsequent years. And it also approves the budget transfers between the adopted budget and October 31st, which is the end of the first interim budget. Kim? On the W drive, I put a PowerPoint. It's called First Interim. Can't get it? Sorry. Last minute. So last time we got together to talk about finances, I think I told you I'd try to make it more entertaining, and I'm here to tell you that it will not be any more entertaining tonight than it ever is. But it will be brief. And it's all pretty much good news, so that's good. Right above that one. There you go. Thank you. Sorry, I forgot to tell you that. So we're in a pretty good financial condition. As you will see from the next slide, our revenues increased, there we go, by over $8 million. Now, I will explain where most of that came from. Obviously, our property taxes came in over 5% higher than they came in last year, so that's very good news for us. That was an increase of $1.6 million. Our federal revenues, that's mostly just carryover and just adjustments in grants that we get for federal. State revenues is a combination of the increase that we got for the mandated cost one-time money that we budgeted at first interim, and also about $2.8 million of that is that STIRS on behalf pension liability that we have to report on our books. It shows in both revenue and expense in the same amount, has no effect on our ending balance, but it's something that we are required to report now. So that's an increase in our state revenues of $2.8 million. It's also an increase to our benefits, as you can see there, of about $2.8 million. And then our local revenues, as you know, just continue going up throughout the year as we do billings and collect different fees for facilities. We make adjustments for certificated and classified salaries as necessary, and benefits. Without the $2.8 million, it would have been pretty close. Books and supplies and services and operations are mostly carryover and new monies that we receive. And then the other big adjustment was the other outgo and the transfers out. We did budget $975,000 to transfer to Fund 20, which wasn't in the original budget. So next slide, please. So overall, the total change to the ending balance was about $924,000 more than we had at the budget adoption. And these are all the changes that went into that $924,000. Again, the property taxes and the one-time mandated cost was the majority of it. You can see further down the transfer to the Fund 20 for our other post-employment benefits was a large part of it as well. Next slide, please. And then just to keep you updated on where we are compared to where we would be if we were an LCFF district. This increase in our property taxes helped us gain over where we would be as an LCFF. So you can see in 15-16, there's still about a $3.5 million difference between the target amount and where we are currently. The amount that we would actually be funded in 15-16, there's still about a $9.5 to $10 million gap there. And then projected through 16-17 and 17-18, we're projecting property taxes at only 2%, which seems likely that it may be more than that. So even with the 2%, we're still going to be at the LCFF levels. And then I didn't include a slide on this, but in your documents, the other funds have all stayed pretty consistent. Some good news that we got is that the adult ed is going to start receiving some state monies for the first time in about 5 or 6 years, I think. We continue to collect developer fees, and things are looking very good. And I think Brian is going to go over the 7-year budget with you.
Can I ask just one question?
Sure.
On one of the slides, it was the changes, and it all about $900,000. I noticed in there the MA is showing money again, or?
Yes, we did.
Okay, thank you. Can you explain that?
Well, I think we're going to start receiving it, but it's still kind of uncertain, so we're not budgeting it in future years. But this was actually, I think, 10-11 money that we received, and we're receiving it at a much lower amount than we were, but we will start receiving it again.
Any other questions? Yes. From Mrs. Lane? Mrs. Sheffer?
I would just like, as always, to just give us a brief explanation, if you would, of what one-time money means. Sort of self-explanatory, but it sometimes gets lost in the shuffle with
it's very important to recognize that, too. One-time money is money that we receive from the state, usually, sometimes from the federal government. We receive it one time as one lump sum. Sometimes we have a certain date that we have to spend it by. And it's not ongoing, so we can't really fund ongoing expenditures like salary increases or something that's going to be ongoing with that type of money. It has to be used for one-time expenses.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Strunger.
Well, and just kind of following up with what Mrs. Sheffer said, I think we always have to remember that we are a community-funded school district, and that community funding status can always be taken away by the state. And so that difference, that $10 million difference, is although we're spending it as ongoing money because we hopefully have assurances it will be, it really is in essence one-time money, and I just think we can't forget about that either, and that's why, thanks to you, we have put aside a substantial
reserve.
Thank you very much. In order to protect us and to protect our employees should something happen, say, with our basic aid status, which is always possible.
Thank you. Any other comments?
So
Mr. Pinkerton.
Yeah, so prior to moving forward in terms of the resolution, I feel like it's nice every interim to go through the seven-year budget, kind of give the board an update where we're at, where projections are. You know, a lot of things, when we do the budget back in May or June when the board approves it, we haven't had the governor sign on the dotted line yet, so, you know, including the one-time funds and doing those types of things. So a lot changes prior to this first interim. And especially in these times when we're looking at one-time funds, those types of things. Again, as we look at the seven-year budget projection, so this is a projection of what might happen, could be wrong, could change, could adapt, but we try to look at our past now that we have a couple of years, both 13-14 and 14-15, that you'll see on this document, are unaudited actuals. That is, those are the real numbers for those 2 years. So as this goes forward, like for 15-16, you know, hey, when we knew for sure we got the one-time funds from the governor, we added that to the revenue. So we definitely changed this over the course of the year, both from a revenue standpoint as well as an expenditure. At the same time, we also try to do projections. For example, Julie showed you a page tonight that showed us spending $4.7 million in materials and supplies. Well, that's what we have budgeted in that account. There's no way we're going to spend every single penny, and we never have, in our materials and supplies account. Normally, it's, and if you look down at the projection, it's about $3.2 million. So we've tried to do that so that the board has a better idea, right, about where we're going to land at the end of the year, and kind of have those, you have a better feeling in terms of security about where we're at. I am conservative, just to be honest, and as we talk to our union groups and the people out there, when we negotiate those types of things, I try to be as conservative as possible in terms of property tax increases. We've seen a couple years where it's been nothing, even negative, and then we've seen 2 years now where it's been 5%. So while we have two, as the economy unfolds, as we see what's going to happen next year in terms of property taxes, we may adjust that as we go into our budget cycle for the 16-17 school year. So the revenues as you go through and expenditures. So the one major change, and I've outlined it in green this time, is the STRS contribution. So basically through the legislation, there's three groups that pay for STRS, which is the state teachers retirement system. Teachers pay, certificated staff pay into that system. The district pays on behalf of the teacher, the certificated employee, and the state pitches in. So as part of the legislation and people knowing about retirement systems and how much they cost, those types of things, the state has now made us put in our budgets the state's benefit that they pay towards the teacher retirement system to kind of show everybody what the state pitches in. That's what those two green lines represent. So you'll see we added in revenue, but then we just take it right out in expenditure. So though it doesn't really change the bottom line of our district, it is really a key factor. And so I think that was just part of the Pension Reform Act and wanting to show kind of the true cost of what pensions cost. So you'll see that now reflected in this document. We've added that in. Does not change the bottom line, but just shows the state's amount. The three things that are highlighted, of course, on the second page in terms of expenditures is that ongoing, which corresponds right with the STRS and the PERS increases that we're going to be seeing over the next 4 to 5 years of roughly 10% per employee, and that's the district's contribution will rise. Employees, their contributions did rise 1% last year. For STRS, all certificated employees will, on their behalf, what they're going to have to pay up will go up 1% as well. So that's their side. But the district also, as you'll see, the substantial increases in terms of retirement costs over the next 5 years does play a huge role in terms of the bottom line for the district. And so, you know, hopefully, cross our fingers, property taxes will remain substantial and be good. And as Mr. Unger pointed out, basic aid status would remain intact, those types of things. But it's definitely something that in the out years, every year we need to consider those personnel costs and how we're going to be able to maintain that kind of 85% area of our total budget with personnel costs. So that's something that I'm constantly looking at and examining as we move forward. So everything else, again, from 15-16 on, we did try to look at projections. As we get real data, we do put it in. And so it does give you a better bottom line. So we had our 13-14, our bottom line. We had a surplus of about $900,000. Mainly that was unspent Common Core funds, that we one-time funds we had received. We had a negative deficit in 14-15. And again, we knew in terms of signing our deal with our employee groups that we were going to receive one-time money to make up for that in 15-16, which we, of course, did. And so it brings us back into kind of a surplus situation again in terms of our overall budget for 15-16 at this point. And so definitely helps. I would predict that there will be more one-time money based on the current economy and how things are going. And so while that's nice, and while 13-14, 14-15, 15-16, those one-time funds has really kept us afloat and things look good and we're doing okay, any downturn in the economy will make that spigot dry up really fast in terms of one-time funds. And so we just have to be cautious of that as we move forward and really maintain, again, that personnel expenditure is really the key area that we need to look at. Health benefits is definitely a concern, I think, probably for everyone, you know, in the United States of America, right, in terms of the cost of health care and what's happening with it. And so for us to look at ways to work with our employee groups to maintain those funds and work on something in that area is definitely something we want to do. We continually work with CISC in trying to, again, last year they were very helpful with allowing us to have an ACA plan for employees and things like that to try to keep those costs at a minimum. So, again, this is the projection. Hopefully this is, again, I think it's been a valuable tool for the board to kind of see the bottom line of where things are falling out. And, it's again, it's a little different than the first interim because we don't always spend everything that's budgeted in the first interim document.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions, Mrs. Shepherd?
Yes. So a couple of questions,
yes.
Ryan. I see on the ending balance where that number is decreasing over time until
yes.
At 2021 we have a negative balance. Is that reflective of our reserves being eroded? Or?
Yes. Oh, yeah. So the ending balance is basically what our reserves are.
Okay. And I have another question then, mm-hmm. based sort of following up on that. It's my understanding that as a basic aid district that one of the reasons we're able to have healthy reserves and some additional funding than perhaps some of our neighboring districts is because of our property taxes. Mm-hmm. And part of that is based upon the fact that we have Diablo. We have PG&E contributing mightily.
Yes.
So what would happen to our tax base and to our status should Diablo cease to operate?
Well, that's, you know, if you look at our total local revenue, so, and I believe Julie had it up there, so for 15-16 it's almost $66 million. So Diablo represents roughly $9 to $10 million of that.
So that would evaporate?
Yes. So that would bring us, again, to the LCFF status that you saw this year. So roughly about that, where we would become an LCFF district. Now, should property taxes remain stable and not go up very much, I think Julie's sheet where it shows that in a couple of years, the LCFF does districts begin to catch up to us, even from our basic aid status, unless we continue to see the 5% growth in property values and those things that, you know, that we've seen over the last 2 years. So that, because that will keep that bar moving up higher than that. But, you know, for us, I think the more funding towards education, more funding towards the LCFF is a positive thing for us because it provides a stability for us should something happen with Diablo Canyon. But it's still a substantial decrease in revenue for the district if something were to happen.
So our status as a community-funded district, we're hanging our hat on basically one property owner to continue with our community-funded status.
Well, it's just $9 to $10 million in one one area.
But
so
that
I mean,
would
it's a lot more than that, but it would definitely drop us right down to the LCFF level.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Thank you for that information.
Sure.
Mr. Quasimary.
Mr. Pinkerton, your projections on the property tax revenue, is that what's the historic basis for that projection?
You know, it's been a little rough over the last couple of years, I would say, over time. You know, it's been more in the 4 to 5% range, probably on an average over the past 10 to 12 years. But we saw some pretty rough years, 11, 12, 12, 13, where it actually were negative property tax increases. So I think that, again, we've just built in a 2% increase a year, which is kind of the norm. Property taxes are going to go up 2%. And then like this year, when we did our budget, we felt like positive nature, real estate was values were up, so we increased that to 3% in our projections. And so I think if we're seeing that same thing for 16, 17, that's something we would definitely add. Now, the other thing that is not in this is any potential increases for salary or benefits for employees. So that's a whole nother, you know, thing that we have to consider and think about as we're putting together our projection, our budget, and really looking at, you know, retirements and replacing employees and those types of things. But definitely the cost of personnel alone, which we know is 85 to 90% of our budget, is going to go up 10% over the next 5 years. That's automatic without any increases in salary. So it's definitely something that I know we talk about it a lot. We're already beginning to have discussions about, you know, budget projections for next year. So we're going to have a meeting in January to talk about where we're at and looking forward and you know, trying to have as least impact on our kids and our schools as possible when we look at personnel. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Pinkerton. So this is a resolution. Would someone like to make a motion?
I'll move approval of resolution number 071516, the first interim report.
I'll second that.
We have a motion by Mr. Unger and a second by Mr. Quessenberry. Mrs. Holmes.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Mr. Quessenberry?
Yes.
Mr. Buckman?
Yes.
Dr. Eisendrath Rogers?
Yes.
Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Mrs. Sheffer? Passes 6-0 with one absence.
Thank you. And then moving on to 10.02, another resolution. The easement for the UMAN fiber optic line. Mr. Palazzo.
Yeah, good evening. As many of you know, if you've had to drive over Los Osos Valley Road, they are in the process of widening the bridge going across the Highway 101. As part of that, we had a UMAN, which is the Unified Metropolitan Area Network, which is our fiber optic loop, which brings us, as we kind of quip in our department, it brings the Google to the site, to the schools. But that is our internet, and our phones actually are transmitted over that as well. We own and operate that utility. It's a private utility. We had a crossing at Los Osos Valley Road across Highway 101 that was an aerial crossing, and we had the opportunity as part of the bridge widening project.
What's an aerial crossing?
A wire up in the air. So we had a wire up in the air over Highway 101, which, as you can imagine, is problematic if there was an issue to maintain or repair, et cetera, et cetera. So we had the opportunity to jump into the bridge as they were widening it. In fact, they needed to move our pole and move our wire and move a bunch of different things to make that bridge happening. And by us actually going underground in through the bridge across Highway 101, we made their construction much easier. It put us in a much better position to repair that if we had a problem. In other words, we don't have to shut Highway 101 down to make any repairs to that line. We can simply, everything can be run underground without anyone ever knowing it's going on. So this long story here kind of comes back to, as part of that process, the new line, underground line, does cross a small piece of city property, and PG&E, the gas company, AT&T, all the other utilities are kind of in the same trench, kind of following the same path, And one of the requirements to be able to cross the city property with our wire is that they grant us an easement. And so this resolution was developed with legal counsel to basically allow us to enter into an easement agreement with the city for that small crossing at near Los Osos Valley Road overpass. So.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions? I have a question.
Yes.
If I'm remembering correctly, when at the time the U-Man went in, it was it supported San Luis Coastal, County Office of Education, Cuesta College. We were all kind of bundled into that together.
It's San Luis Coastal. Cal Poly has a little teeny piece of it. The County of San Luis Obispo is kind of our 50-50 partner in it. Cuesta does have a little piece, I believe, and County Office actually brings the Google in, as we call it. We actually work with them to actually have the Internet enter through the U-Man through the County Office. So, yeah, it is definitely a joint powers, if you will, system, but the County of San Luis Obispo and San Luis Coastal are the two main users of the system. And so we split a lot of these costs 50-50 as part of our agreement with them.
But the agreement would be we would be the only...
We are the owner and operators of it, so we get the easement.
Okay, thank you. Well, then if there are no other questions, I'll entertain a motion. Oh, Mr. Buckman.
Just real quickly. Anthony, so the extent of the U-Man, in my mind, it ran all the way down Los Osos Valley Road, and it took care of the coastal schools.
It's a four-hour drive to drive the whole thing.
About
2 hours, actually.
2 hours.
So it's, you know, I should have had the numbers. It's...
Oh, that's
it's... Yeah, I can't even. We have the stats, but it's 50 miles or so as it runs all around.
I'm just trying to make the picture in my head match.
Yeah, it hits every one of our schools. So it goes through the city, out Los Osos Valley Road. It kind of cuts across, goes out to the coast, comes across over to Morro Bay, comes back down Highway 1. Yeah, it's...
So my question is maybe more for Kimberly than for you, but as we experience this new technology gap and the Wi-Fi gap, is there any possibility that we could actually tap in, or has there been discussion about tapping into the U-Man to serve neighborhoods and communities with, so our students would have access everywhere? Maybe that's a question. Maybe you could come back with an answer sometime in the next 5 years.
Look into that.
Yeah. Thanks.
Okay, any other questions?
Sorry, you're asking a non-tech guy that question, so it's just like deer in the headlights.
So could you design a box that we could put in?
Oh, we could certainly do that,
great.
Yeah. And I can get the wires everywhere, but...
I would like to entertain a motion then on this resolution.
I'll move the resolution. I just don't see a number on it. Is that, or am I getting the wrong number? 8? Okay. 8, 15, 16?
It says 1415.
Okay, so resolution 81516.
There may be a typo in the actual resolution. The correct number for the resolution is 81516.
That's the resolution I'm moving.
So I have a motion by Mr. Questenberry, a second by Mrs. Sheffer. Mrs. Holmes.
Mr. Questenberry.
Aye.
Mrs. Sheffer.
Yes.
Mrs. Roger.
Yes.
Dr. Eisendrath Rogers.
Yes.
Mr. Buckman.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry, I missed Mr. Unger. Down there in the hinterlands. Yeah. Passes 6-0 with one absence.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Moving on, item 11.1, model classrooms and one-to-one devices. Looks like we have Mrs. McGrath and Jennifer O'Hagan.
Great. So tonight, Mrs. O'Hagan and I are happy to give you an update on our model classrooms, which we started in 2013 and have completed our second round, and would love to give you an update on where things are with model classrooms. So, let me tap it. I'll tap. Yeah. So just to remind you, we started in 2013 and 14 with about one or two teachers per school site that we gave a short little questionnaire to and said, we realized as we went around and got feedback about our LCAP that a lot of teachers said, we absolutely see that technology is the direction that students are headed, that that's what they need for college and careers. Some of us just don't understand yet exactly what that could look like in our classrooms, and we would love to see some real examples. So we had these wonderful people that applied and said, I'll be the first guinea pig. And we started with the option of iPads, Chromebooks, or laptops, and said, we would love your feedback. You know, check these out. Find the pros and cons. Let's really dig in and see what you think. And they were excellent. So they served a wonderful purpose of trying things with students, being a model and a resource for the teachers at each of their school sites, and then also giving us a lot of feedback about what's working, what's not working, etc. So it was successful enough that we said, let's go on to round two. So for 14 and 15, we funded model classrooms for round two, also did just a short little two-question application and said, let us know, how are you going to use devices to truly personalize learning and to differentiate, and how are we going to use these to further engage students? So we had a fantastic group that now we have this great group of EdTech lead teachers at school sites that are able to model lessons, give great feedback to us, as well as lead their school sites in moving forward with technology. So we've started, rolling out these devices, and then after we did these model classrooms, we've also had a little bit of an innovative way of replacing devices. So as you have approved and provided the opportunity to replace devices as they get too old to function well, what we've done is we've said, okay, site principal, here's the devices that need to go. These are the devices that are 8, 7 years old is about what we're replacing, and here's the pocket of money that can replace that for you. But instead of just going a straight replacement, we'd like for you to think about, what does your site need? Perhaps if it's a teacher computer, you might need to just replace it one-to-one. But perhaps it's a computer in the back of the classroom that maybe you think there might be a better way to serve students. So we allowed some flexibility in that funding of their replacement budget. And you can see that over on the left column, for our K-1 classrooms, that 6-1 means that our goal is to have six devices for every one student. I think I'll turn that around. One device for every six students. So that's what we mean by 6-1, that we don't see a necessary need for kindergarten and first grade students to all have a device in their hand all day long. And so you can see kind of where we are at our different school sites, where we've met that target or we're getting close or we're making steps but not there yet. In second grade, you can see that our goal was 4-1, third grade 4-1. We may, want more devices in second and third as time goes on, but that's kind of where we're sitting now, with fourth grade, fifth and sixth and seventh and eighth being a typical 1-1, we believe, is our goal there. And I'll talk a little about 9th through 12th and our high school model, which might look a little different. So I want to talk to you a little tonight about what are our goals, what purpose is this, and what are we trying to accomplish with rolling out technology in model classrooms. So we're looking to utilize technology for these goals and this purpose. We wanted to create model classrooms so that teachers could really get a visual and could see, I get it, this is what using technology, how it could be utilized to truly take learning to another level. Because none of us are interested in a $300 shiny pencil, right? We want to see how can technology be used to better our instruction and to take it to a place that may not have been possible without technology. We're looking to create teacher leaders within each school site so that they can serve as a model and can be an example and help others with that learning curve. Our main two goals here are to personalize learning, so to use technology for the science of teaching, not the art of teaching, so that what can technology do in order to meet students' individual needs? That's one of our driving questions, as well as engaging students, right? Creating a modern environment that would engage them. and finally progressed lessons up the SAMR model. So we've talked a little about SAMR before, and Jen's going to explain that a little further and also give you some great classroom examples.
Okay. All right, so we've alluded to the SAMR model before last year a little bit in some of our presentations, and so I just want to give you a quick, I'm going to take you through some steps and what it looks like with a sample lesson. So basically it's a useful tool for helping teachers identify where they're at, their comfort level in utilizing technology in the classroom, and how to design effective student learning experiences. So let's take an example of an original task. Students would be asked to write a report or produce a report on the Chumash Indians and perhaps make a poster board. Okay, so the bottom level of SAMR is called, it stands for substitution, and that's where technology acts as a direct substitute with no functional change. That's kind of where Kim said, you know, we don't want $400 or $500 pencils. That might look like using Google Slides to make an electronic presentation. So you would do that instead of the poster board. And that's great. A lot of our teachers are at the substitution level, but we want to keep moving them up. So at the augmentation level, the technology is still a direct substitute, but there's going to be some functional improvement here now. So students would still be using that Google Slide presentation and using research from the internet to create the project. And they might be inserting hyperlinks and things like that to their project. And they'll also be able to possibly share it with the teacher electronically instead of just turning in a paper presentation. And so that dotted line there now is where we want to start moving our lessons in our classrooms. So when we get to the modification step, this is where you're going to be seeing some redesign of the original task, and that would look like a Google slideshow, but perhaps the students are now sharing the slideshow with their peers and working more collaboratively with it. So students could actually work from home. So you could have a student in a different area on campus in the library and one in the classroom and one from home, all working together collaboratively and sharing and providing comments and feedback to each other, all in real time. And the teacher would also be able to manage this as well from his or her end and provide feedback and comments. And then at the redefinition level, this is where the tech has actually allowed for something previously inconceivable. So it's basically redoing the entire task to something that could not have been done without technology. So an example might be to now take this Google slideshow presentation and do a screencast and have the students narrate over it and record it and turn it into a video that can be posted on a class website that they've designed that can be accessible to others within the school, outside the school, parents, and other schools. So that's the goal. We want to see our teachers, they're all getting off to great starts, and some of them have already jumped over that line with specific lessons. Some lessons lend themselves more easily to jump up to the modification and redefinition levels. So what I want to do now is show you a screencast that Mr. Curran in third grade has made for you, explaining how he has moved his lesson up the SAMR ladder here. So let me see if I can get this for you.
Hello, my name is David Curran.
Turn it up. Do we have volume? Oh, sorry.
I'm a third grade teacher at Baywood Elementary working with a model classroom. So what you're about to see, third graders did it, ages 7 and 8. They are technology rock stars. So we did a lesson involving research on Chumash Indians. Let's just dive into it. We're going fast and furious. So the students first accessed a website. I pushed that out through a Google Classroom. They were able to access that on their individual Chromebooks. And then from there, the students were writing down information from that website into a Google Slide. So all kids, they have their own Chromebook, and they have access to a shared Google Slide. Basically, I just click on Sharing Properties here, and I can have every student able to access this same document where they can have live updates, you know, conversations within the document. They can make comments and have chats. It's really phenomenal what is capable within a Google Slide and a lot of Google's applications. So all students are working on this Google Slide at once. It's basically Google's version of PowerPoint with a lot of differences, but what we were able to do within Google Slide that I think is really powerful is just the connectivity. All kids can read each other's work, they can see each other's progress, and they can also comment on other groups' work as well. So each group, there was an economy group, I had a food group, a government group, and they're all looking for, you know, Chumash economy, Chumash government, Chumash recreation, and they were putting down information into each Google Slide. So here's an example of what the Google Slide looked like before. It's very blank. This is kind of a sheer skeleton of the assignment, and this is what the students created afterwards. It's absolutely amazing what they're able to do. They have different colors, different pictures. They're even putting arrows in to describe what text goes with the pictures. I didn't even ask them to do that. But what is really, really neat, and what I think is really powerful for the students to see, is that the audience they are making this this assignment for is larger than just myself and larger than just themselves. So I'm able to make comments. I can, you know, tell a group that they're doing a great job, they've been working hard, that their content looks great. I can also share this with my sharing options. I can share this assignment with my colleagues. And so my instructional coach at my site, Kristen May, who's great, she was able to comment on my students' work as well, and it's just cool for the kids to see other staff members and just a larger audience involved in their work. So it's really, really neat. And the kids just absolutely love Google Slides. It really motivates them to work for a larger audience. This is my friend Lucas, one of my third grade pals, and Lucas has something to say about Google Slides. This is an exact quote from him. He said, "You can do so much more on Google Slides than you can on paper. Well, except for the fact that you can't make origami with Google Slides. Other than that, it is awesome for most things." That's from Lucas. Thank you for listening.
Okay. So that's straight from the mouth of a model classroom teacher and his student, Lucas. Okay. So with that, we definitely need to continue our professional development. And SAMR will definitely be a part of that. We have several options as far as professional development goes for technology, and I have alluded to this in the past. We have district-level professional development available to our teachers and staff. This past summer, we had a very successful summer techie teacher boot camp that was well-received by our teachers, and we had standing room only in many of the sessions. We also offered elementary and secondary professional development days, and they have been workshop style, so the teachers have different choices and sessions and options available to them, where we use some of our ed tech lead teachers and other techie teachers as presenters to develop workshops specifically for our teachers, and that way it kind of personalizes and individualizes the workshop levels for our teachers. So some of them can go to beginning workshops and others can go to more intermediate and advanced. And then new this year are techie teacher workshops. So on Tuesdays, I just finished one right before I came over here, we have after-school workshops available at various locations throughout the district where teachers can come again and get professional development in a classroom setting with myself and some other ed tech leads. At the site level, I am using the ed tech lead teachers mostly for this. During TCT times, we're organizing our teachers to receive professional development and training as far as using devices in the classroom, starting to implement more SAMR lessons and things like that and showing them how to do that. Staff meetings are another place where we're seeing in some sites they're offering little tips and tech tips and Google Slams and different things like that at a staff meeting. And then at other sites, they're offering office hours after school, so the ed tech lead teacher might be available for teachers to come after school at a designated time to get one-on-one help or small group help. And then one of my favorite things is the classroom level PD option, and that's where I've been going into classes all over the district, different grade levels from second grade all the way up to high school, and showing the teachers how to teach using the device, you know, or using the Google app. So I'll take over a class and I'll do maybe schedule a series of lessons on how to use Google Classroom and how to implement what they're already teaching digitally, or how to use their Chromebooks and things like that. So I have a blast doing that. It's really fun and it's really powerful for the teachers as well to see me get up in front of the students and try things and take risks. It allows them to feel more comfortable taking risks as well. So here's an example then of what I put together for our teachers, for our district. I took all the workshops and things that our EdTech leads had done, all the presentations and the handouts and things, and put it together on a website that's linked to the EdTech website, and I'll just show you what that looks like real quick. So this is available to everybody. So if a teacher wanted to learn more about coding, they can click here and access some how-tos on coding. That's not a good example. Let me give you a better one. So here's a Docs and Drive. So you can click here, and you can see a YouTube video and get more information this way. So I'm constantly adding to this and updating it. But this is designed to support our teachers and staff as we continue to roll out Google. So as you can see, there's all sorts of resources here. Okay. All right. And so we wanted to show you what the impact all of this technology is having on our classrooms and our students. So I went to a couple of our second round model classrooms, one's elementary and one's secondary, and asked the teachers and some of the students, what has changed now that you have technology, now that you have Chromebooks or devices in your class? How has your learning changed? What kinds of things are you doing now that you couldn't do before? How has your teaching changed? What are you seeing in your students? And so here's a quick video on just that.
Well, we're using our Chromebooks right now for publishing our writing on Google Docs, and we'll use them in slides for presentations. We're also using them for emailing each other for only school appropriate stuff, like questions about homework or study buddies.
We've kind of started to draft a little bit on Chromebooks, which is totally new and different for the kids. And watching them draft on Chromebooks, it just seems to me like they're being more thoughtful about it. It's almost like that's a completely different experience for them than drafting on paper. And it's been very fascinating to me. I will go in and comment on their documents. Or every now and then they'll see me pop in, and it's still very new and exciting for the kids when they see me pop in. They go, and then they remember that they can keep working. Oftentimes I'll go in and just kind of give them a couple little reminders about formatting, or have you proofread yet? And I'll send them a little reminder, or I'll type something in, and they'll see it, and then they'll go ahead and fix whatever I was seeing. And then what's really nice as well is they can go back in and have a second go at it if they did after I've graded it, which is really nice too, because then they get an opportunity to apply some of the comments I've made on the right, or they can ask me questions by replying to my comments. So that's really nice, because I don't always get an opportunity when I've graded something traditionally to sit down with a student and actually give them specific feedback. So it's really nice to get some of the comments, and we can kind of have a conversation that way on that one.
Some of the stuff I'm able to do as a teacher now that I could not do before we got these Chromebooks in the classroom, I'm able to give instantaneous feedback to the students when they turn in work. They are able to take all of their assessments, quizzes, and tests online to make it more accessible to them. One of the biggest things for them, and I think one of the most important things, is when a student is absent in class, they don't feel like that they're missing out on all the work, whether the class notes, handouts, assessments are all online and accessible from any device, whether it be in your home or somewhere else on campus. So a student doesn't have to come the next day and ask the teacher what they missed or feel like that they missed anything. They're able to stay caught up with the class even when they're not present in school.
In class, we do a lot of research projects, and the Chromebooks help us a lot to do their research in class and in front of them, so we can do it while we're sick. And he can share things with us on his website and features to keep in touch with him while we're in school.
I like being able to watch the presentation and see what I'm doing on my computer without having to look at the classroom time. If I don't really understand something, I can kind of go back in the presentation. It's at my own pace.
They're making a website.
Did you ever think you'd be building a website in the freshman hall?
No, never.
Okay, that sounded like it was underwater. So basically, Kimberly Kelly was explaining how students can, she can really use that comment feature to individualize and have a one-on-one discussion with her kids back and forth in real time. So you don't have to wait till an assignment's turned in anymore. You can actually give students feedback and catch them and have them give them opportunities to revisit their work in real time instead of that delay. And then these students were actually in freshman health. Rather than doing the poster boards, they created websites to highlight their projects on drugs and alcohol. And at the end, I had asked one of the students, did you ever think you'd be building a website in freshman health? And he said, no, it was really cool. So it was just, those were the two things I really wanted you to take from that video. And maybe you can see it another time when the sound looks a little bit better. So I think this is Kim right here on the next steps. So when we're thinking about our next steps, our goals for technology, obviously we need more professional development and to continue with that. So we have our ed tech leads at each site so that they can really help lead teachers right from the classroom example like Jen was giving there. We have our summer boot camp that was really successful. We want to be able to continue that and also probably incorporate more with administrators. Our next goal is to focus on expansion. So my next goal is to really work towards Laguna being the next one-to-one school. I think we're pretty close. Los Osos, we got there this year. It's fantastic. And we're maybe about halfway with Laguna. And so that's our next goal. And then our high school model, as you well know, we made a lot of strides with Wi-Fi this summer for the high schools. And we're having to do some creative solutions because of construction. But that's our next goal. We've been working a lot with the high schools on what can it look like for you so that we're not having to wait till construction's finished in order to continue to make progress there at the high schools. And then obviously the SAMR model. That's why we took a little time for you to really understand that, because having teachers understand how to take a lesson and really move it up to that M and R level is our goal for technology. So just want to finish with a quick little video that is from an elementary school that highlighted the Hour of Code was a great way to show how you see kids collaborating, real excitement around technology, and this was a great opportunity for our kids. We will end after this with any questions you have. Final map there showed all the places where the Hour of Code was taking place, and that was one example from our own little Sinsheimer. So, great. Any questions you have about model classrooms and progress we're making with technology?
Thank you. I just have an observation and then a question. So the observation is that as I look at some of these teachers, we have some quite senior teachers that are participating in these programs. Okay. I just wanted to point that out because quite often people think that once you've taught 15, 20 years, you get sort of ossified and You know, you're out there in the elephant or dinosaur boneyard, but that's not true. And I just wanted to point that out. The other thing is, I have a question, and it's going to sound, well, I'll just reveal my ignorance right now. What is the difference between coding and programming? And is there one?
Yeah, I think there is. There's a difference. But I'm probably not the expert on that. But coding, you would be, it's kind of like building blocks to programming. So you're starting, I think they definitely go hand in hand. But the hour of coding is great because it's teaching kids concepts that they are using at Harvard and all of these Ivy League schools. And then it's getting them ready for programming and actually telling something what to do.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Anyone else? Okay, then. Thank you very much for the presentation. It was wonderful. Moving on, item 11.2, approve the local control accountability plan timeline. Mr. Robinette.
Thank you. The local control accountability plan, or LCAP, is a state requirement that links our funding and budget priorities with student achievement and other measurable outcomes, with a specific focus on students of socioeconomic disadvantage, EL students, homeless, foster youth. When done poorly, it is troublesome compliance. It's a document that we complete every year, put in a shelf, then blow the dust off and do it again. When done well, it becomes inextricably linked to the very initiatives that move a district forward, and I believe we are doing it well. Our LCAP has been designed with our board's strategic initiatives as the primary driver. It has been developed with broad input from our school, parent, and student community. It is incorporated into our district's LEA plan, and it's reflected in every single school's individual site accountability plan. Our instructional services and student services departments analyze our progress on a monthly basis. It is a responsive and somewhat malleable plan, though we adopt it every June, and we feel it is important to stay the course on what appears to our departments to be a very worthwhile journey as a school district, focusing on reading, writing, mathematics, STEAM education, technology, career technical innovations, a culture of care, and inroads toward closing the learning and opportunity gap that exists within the cultures of our district. We also want to be nimble and able to adapt to the rapid changes we are facing within the educational realm. So I'd like to share our timeline for development of this year's LCAP, and it's in your board documents, and there it is. First of all, we met with our county office about a month ago, November 17th, to review our progress and any new mandates for us to follow. The county has oversights over the LCAP. They have an approval process just as the board does. We are clearly ahead of the curve with respect to the amount of outreach we do, the transparency of our documents, and our internal progress monitoring. The fact that in pretty much every one of our board meetings, we have calendared a specific LCAP topic as a board report is testament to this. Tonight, we highlighted our technology initiative, which is all part of Focus Area 5. And we've tried to make sure we do that consistently throughout the school year so that you're kept apprised, the public's kept apprised of the progress we're making with our LCAP. One of the changes I found interesting from the county meeting is that when LCAP was first introduced, it was to be set up as a three-year plan, and then with an annual adoption, and then a new plan is written for another three-year period. It is set up to be a three-year plan, but it's kind of a cycling plan. The idea is that we are now expected to do is monitor and adjust our plan. It's kind of a continuous three-year cycle, just rolling the dates and performance expectations forward and adding and subtracting components as we go. So we're not, again, writing something, putting it away 3 years later, kind of looking at it again, but have it be kind of a continuous process, which makes terrific sense. Our internal mid-year evaluation comes in January. It's what we'll be doing as soon as we get back from the winter break. And this coincides with some decision-making that we need to do with regard to personnel decisions. If we have personnel cuts, we need to take care of those things before March. So we start looking in earnest at our plan as it affects personnel right away. We consider February and March to be consultation and outreach months. We will visit faculty and staffs at all 15 school sites. We have parent links published in all of our school newsletters for feedback, for anonymous feedback to be collected. We will have meetings with our identified parent support groups, PTAs, boosters, Title I advisory, English language advisory groups. Last year, we were most struck by the candor and input of our middle school and high school students, and so we will absolutely continue that. We will meet with our collective bargaining union leadership also during that period. I really believe that by reaching out to our parents, we're also reaching out to other community groups. I mean, it is one of the ways we get input about from our larger community of how we're doing. I can tell you that Ryan, Kristen, Eric, and I are exhausted with presentations and feedback. I think within that February-March period, we have about 22 separate meetings that we're conducting, gathering feedback. Actually, yeah, about 24 meetings over that period of time. Kim McGrath, Amy Shields, and Diane Frost become our primary plan writers in April, and then we plan on bringing the LCAP forward as in a series of meetings in April, May, and June, as you see at the bottom there, for further public input before adoption. So tonight we're asking that the board discuss, approve, tell us any changes you'd like to see in our timeline so we can begin in earnest when we get back from the winter break on the whole LCAP season. Thank you.
Mr. Render.
Yeah, thanks, Rick. I think the one thing that I believe we're missing here, and I'm not going to suggest that you guys go out and have extra meetings, but I would like to see a statement in this LCAP timeline about outreach to other community groups, whether it be just the availability of going to our website and giving us feedback, something, because my understanding is the intention of the LCAP is to reach out beyond the school community and to the community at large, and I think we need to state that in our timeline. And how we accomplish that, I understand that last year we didn't get a lot of feedback from those groups, but I think we need to at least offer up to them the ability to give us feedback and have specific ways of doing that. And the other thing you said something interesting, Rick, and I'd like you to consider this. On our board agenda items, hearing you say, for example, that the presentation we saw in the model classrooms related to the technology part of our strategic initiative, it would be kind of neat if we could see on our agenda items, for me personally, I don't know how the rest of the board feels, to be able to relate those agenda items to the strategic initiatives and perhaps a part of the LCAP. So we could easily go back and say to people, we talked about this on this date and during this time. And
that's a great idea.
It would be one more way we could demonstrate transparency. And that. Thank you.
Mr. Quesenberry.
Well, I was just curious. Chris, when you were talking about other community groups, I know that at one point in the LCAP we reached out to various churches. Is that correct?
We made an attempt to kind of reach out to ecumenical groups to come in, and we didn't get any takers with that particular group.
Right.
We had chamber group and mixer to bring chamber people from the different communities in. We had kind of community service groups. We had business leaders, but that was the one group that I don't think we had any takers, and so we tried.
And how would you describe the response from, let's say, the Chamber of Commerce or other service groups?
People were happy to come and have lunch and talk with us, but they kind of, I mean, I'm generalizing, but kind of the message was, hey, the school district's great, you're doing fine, I don't really have anything to tell you. So it was a very encouraging meeting, like a lot of happy people about what they're hearing about our school district, happy to get the information and that we shared, but not a lot of input into kind of changes or suggestions for us, as opposed to our teachers, our principals, our parents, our students, who actually say, here's some ideas for you.
So do you think this would be worthwhile to do on a yearly basis or every other year? Do you think we derive any positive publicity from it or input that makes a significant difference in the way we plan things and do things?
I wish I knew, because as Mr. Unger said, the whole idea behind a local control accountability plan is you want your local community, not just the people who are in the trenches, but your local community weighing in on what they want from their school district. So however we can get to that, we're open. It's sometimes easier said than done figuring out how to bring that that kind of input in a valuable way to what we're actually doing on a day-to-day basis. We really get a lot of good feedback from our parents, who I'm sure are connected with those groups, but that might not be one and the same. I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know if Dr. Prater has any ideas about that too, but I mean, we're open to trying things, that's for sure.
Thank you, Mr. Robinette.
You know, we've been throwing around the idea of doing a coast and a city forum, a community forum, if you will, where we entertain feedback. However, what makes it tricky, because we've done this before, the first time out, and what makes it tricky is it becomes an issues session as opposed to a think tank feedback session. So framing those public forums becomes the challenge, so people can provide meaningful feedback. So one of the things that I recall us hearing from the PTA leaders, this was a couple years ago, and we took it to heart, was they would like to be front-loaded well in advance of the meeting so that they can come to the forum or to the session with meaningful feedback, thoughtful feedback, because they want to provide good ideas and good suggestions, but the way we've historically framed these sessions, it's been come to the meeting, here's your information, now tell us what you think. And so I think a more thoughtful examination of how we frame the meetings will elicit better feedback. And so and I think, Mr. Unger, that's what I'm hearing you say. And so given all the things that our team has talked about, given the things we've learned through various conferences, I think we can, this time around, frame out a community forum on the coast and in the city, frame out the actual meeting itself in a way where we elicit sort of a more of a authentic, well thought out, and considered feedback loop based on our front loading of information through the initiatives. And I think we'll get more of what we're looking for. And so I'm certainly willing and able to organize that and make it happen. We're doing that actually with our students. Our first time through last year, we gleaned, as Mr. Robinette said, some really great feedback. But after it was done, we started throwing around ideas like, wow, I wonder if we did it a little differently and gave students information a little more in advance, and then we scheduled the meeting. And those are the things that we're thinking about. And so what I was hoping for was a formal adoption, if you will, or approval of this framework, and then we can, understanding that this is dynamic, and that as we go into the break, I fully intend to develop with our team some refinements to this. And I think the community forum could address maybe not the religious component per se, but that might be an unexpected kind of contribution to it as well.
Mrs. Sheffer.
I think that I know that last year we had made several attempts to reach out to the community at large and didn't necessarily have a robust response. I know that we, having attended some of the meetings with students, they were so informative, I know for a fact that we didn't just make the effort, we succeeded in speaking with students across the board from every socioeconomic strata, from all kinds of classes, from CTE to honors to AP to, you know, all students were present and accounted for in terms of having input. And I would say that I think I applaud efforts to continue outreach to the community at large and to parents and families, but I would also say that in terms of staff time and effort, I think that perhaps the fact that we do so much already with our websites and with our appearances and with the things that we do with the information we provide to the community and to the students could perhaps be one of the reasons some of our community efforts are not well attended, that people are feeling that they have information, that they are informed. I think that the satisfaction of our community could be somewhat reflected in the passage of our bond, that they feel good enough about our district to support us through their pocketbooks. I don't want to stop making those efforts, but I also don't want to expend lots and lots of staff time. We can't make people come, and perhaps it's a reflection of somewhat of a level of satisfaction that they don't feel the need, because I think people come out and attend things frequently when they're not happy, when they have, but I think making ourselves available, making the opportunities available to interact with us are always welcome, but I don't think we should see it as a negative if they are not always fruitful. So.
Okay, Mr. Buckman.
Thank you. I have to agree with Ms. Sheffer in terms of the staff time, and there are some tremendous models around the state that have been successful in reaching out, and I think part of saving staff time may be to sort of front load ourselves with what's worked in other communities. And we did there was a gentleman, was it Fulmer? There was a book. Terry Main was helping us. Jamie Fulmer. That room was packed both afternoon and night, and there had to be a reason why. And I'm not sure what you guys did to get everybody there, but we've done it. So sort of spend some time, but spend it wisely.
Dr. Eisendrath Rogers.
Oh, thank you. I was just wondering, just a thought to throw out there, whether you might be able to front load the information, because I do understand what you're saying. People come to the meeting, you spend the time informing them, and then there's a little time for them to interact or to process really even what their ideas might be and how they might respond. So I'm wondering if we could enlist Jennifer O'Hagan and that whole group to produce something, to put on our website that front loads the information, and then have an opportunity for people to respond online or to come to a presentation where we then respond to the various comments we get from the community. So that was just a thought, having watched what we saw earlier and the enthusiasm from those teachers and how we might, because I feel like there are people out there who would be great contributors to the big ideas we're having, but they don't know where to insert themselves. So
thank you.
Just a thought.
Okay, any other comments? Then what we're looking for at this time is an approval.
So I guess with some of this feedback and tweaking our calendar and figuring out whether it's, you know, more outreach in the form of our website or producing videos or community forums in the coast and the city or looking at what other districts have done, I think what we're asking is to at least approve the skeleton. Paying attention, I think, especially to those April and May dates, we really want to kind of highlight three times in front of the board plus an adoption so that it's, you know, that's when the rubber meets the road and where the public, we really want the public to be able to say after April 19th, yes, no, good idea, bad idea, and for the superintendent to be able to respond to those things, which is in the law. So especially those dates in April and May is kind of approving that part of the calendar would be helpful for us.
Okay. Mr. Quisenberry.
I just want to move approval of this LCAP calendar.
So we have a motion by Mr. Quisenberry, a second by Mrs. Sheffer. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
Opposed? That passes 6-0. Item 11.03, approval of the transitional kindergarten waiver. Mrs. Shields.
Hi. Good evening. This went to public hearing at our last board meeting, and I'm now here to bring it directly to the board for your approval. Education code requires that transitional kindergarten minutes be the same as kindergarten. And over the last 2-3 years, as we've fully developed our TK program, we've also extended and expanded our kindergarten program to better align with the rigorous demands of Common Core. And so with that, we are requesting your approval to submit a waiver so that our TK is really about a half-day program, and our kindergarten program at all of our school sites is much more than a half-day. It varies from site to site, but they all have extended days, and you can see the average being, 240 instructional minutes per day. So I'm seeking your approval tonight.
I'll move approval of this item, which is to approve the transitional kindergarten time day waiver, minutes waiver.
Equity length of time waiver.
Okay, I'm happy to second that motion, but I do have a question. When I read through this, I noticed that the difference in the instructional minutes for kindergarten is 240 per day, and for TK is 228, so we have a difference of 12 minutes.
That's a minimal, and that's a daily, so it would be then added to weekly. But some of our kindergarten programs actually go full day, 3 days a week, 4 days a week. Some do a staggered day where half the kids come for the first hour, then all the kids come, and so we wouldn't be able to count that for all of the students. Each of our schools does something a bit unique in kinder, but all of them have an extended program.
Does so it's help? More complex than just 12 minutes.
Yes, it's much
difference.
More complex than that.
Okay, thank you. So we have a motion by Mr. Unger, second by myself. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Passes 6-0. Thank you, Mrs. Shields. 11.04, Measure D, issue an RFQ for an architect to develop bridging documents. Mr. Pinkerton, Mr. Palazzo.
Yeah, so as we discussed a little bit with my Measure D update, we've kind of gone backtrack, okay, what do we need to do to get this going? And the board has given us approval to move forward with the design build project. Now for the rest of the projects at both Slo High as well as Morobe High School. So part of that process of moving forward with the design build is having bridging documents. And I'm going to have Anthony kind of talk about what those bridging documents are. But as kind of a backdrop, we have several projects that the board has approved for design bid build. And those are projects kind of like the pool at Morobe High School where we hire an architect. They design the entire project. It goes into DSA. The board gets to approve that project. So we can modify it, change it, design it exactly as we like it. And then it gets put out to bid. Design build is a little different in that we'll be hiring a contractor architect team that will work with the district to build our projects. So as part of that, what we want to do is kind of get that initial document, which is called bridging documents, for them to, after they go through the qualification process, to use kind of as their bid. So this is our method of really developing a schematic design document so that we can be as specific as possible, as well as with our specifications, in kind of what our expectations are as we move forward with that process. So I'm going to have Anthony kind of talk a little bit more about those documents, and then of course Mr. Holcomb is here as well and can add to that discussion as well.
I actually don't have much more than that. I think Mr. Pinkerton did a great job of kind of describing that, but it is taking the planning documents and the concepts that we've developed so far and really putting real-world spaces to those ideas and concepts, real definitive outlines of what classrooms will look like, real-world visions of what the elevations, the front, the sides, and the backs, and the roof of the building would look like. It'll drill down into where all the storage spaces are. It'll really be the what the building will be from a functional and aesthetic standpoint. And then those will get turned over to, as Mr. Pinkerton said, to a contractor, architect team to then solve all those technical problems. Should we build it out of wood? Should we build it out of steel? Should we weld the steel? Should we bolt the steel? Should we use caissons for the foundations, or should we use spread footings? You know, all those technical type things will then get solved by the architect contractor team. And the idea is that these bridging documents will allow them to give a gravity or a rough order of magnitude of cost and a methodology for costing the project. And then when we make the final determinations, then they can really drill into what that is. And I think some of the nuances of it are still yet to be worked out in terms of our RFP process for the final design build entity. But we do need to get going on the bridging documents to get prepared for that final request for proposals from the design build entities. The other piece, too, is timing is very important because we want to get input from our sites, we want to get input from our instructors, our teachers, our staff, and those folks are only here till about June. And we want to be ready to go out late spring, early summer with this final request for proposals for design build. So we want to have those folks here and engaged in that process of developing these bid documents and developing these designs for our design build entities. So kind of once we finish these drawings up and turn them over, quite a bit of our control kind of goes away at that point. And you know, we'll still have stop checks throughout the process of developing it in terms of, you know, we can't approve and disapprove or you know, reject, I guess, better word, you know, some of the things, but there could be cost implications, there could be time implications, et cetera. So it is kind of a fluid process, but the idea is to put as much definition as we can to prepare for that proposal process as part of these bridging documents. And we have put together an RFQ that will go out presumably tomorrow if the board chooses to approve of this evening. And we'll start soliciting qualifications from architects and in January.
So the second piece of that, talk a little bit about specifications.
Oh, yeah. So simultaneously, we've been, as a district, developing district standard specifications. So that, you know, we talk about drawings, bridging drawings or schematic drawings, and those kind of show quantity and location of all the things, where the walls are, how thick the walls are, how tall the walls are, what the windows look like. But the specifications describe the quality of the materials that we're putting in. So it's windows of a certain quality, it's flooring of a certain quality, it's ceilings of a certain quality and color and type and feel. And so those things we've been developing on our own through our maintenance department. Some of our, we've worked through our model classroom program with some of our site staff, and as well as district maintenance and the management team have been kind of putting those documents together, and those get folded in with our bridging documents as kind of setting that quality level of the products that we want as well. So those combined with what we'll be developing here with this RFQ for bridging documents would make up our final set of documents that will go to the contractors for the proposal process.
Okay, Mr. Holcomb, did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
Not very.
Okay.
But in kind of a shorthand, this is the way we refine exactly what we expect out of our team of an architect and a contractor. So this is the visual representation of it. Then, of course, we'll have contract documents which further enumerate that.
Thank you. Okay, as it was explained to me by Mr. Pinkerton when I asked him for sort of fill me in on the bridging documents, mm-hmm. and I think you explained to me that by law the person who creates the bridging documents cannot participate in bidding.
So the reason why we have a pool of architects that we've approved and have tied in. Unfortunately, for those architects to be part of a design build team, they cannot produce the bridging documents. So we felt like it was in our best interest to go out, do an RFQ for architects to prepare these, because our current architects, if they want to bid on those, would not be able to do the bridging documents themselves. So that's kind of one of the key purposes of why we need to go out.
Mr. Holcomb.
But it is written into code that we have to use a design professional to do these. So we can't just internally generate our documents. So we need that stamp of approval that it's an engineer or an architect. And, of course, we'll use an architect in this case.
So if local architects are already involved with the design bid build projects that we are hoping that are underway or will soon be breaking ground, then we would not expect any of them to participate in creating the bridging documents. Therefore, we might be looking at an architect from out of the area.
You know, it's an opportunity to get another objective look at it, so that's certainly a possibility. But there may be someone local that's uniquely qualified and is not in your pool of existing architects where there's no conflict.
Okay, thank you. I'm reminded that I need to go to the public on each of these items. Is there anyone in the public that would like to comment? Seeing no one, is there any additional board comment?
Is this an action item we need to vote?
I believe it is.
I would like to move approval of issuing an RFQ for architect to develop bridging documents under Measure D.
I'll second that.
So we have a motion by Mrs. Sheffer, a second by Mr. Quessenberry. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Passes 6-0. Thank you. 11.05 is approve new employment contracts for the superintendent, assistant superintendent for business, and assistant superintendent for educational services. Let's see who's presenting that one. Dr. Prater.
The duration of the executive contracts has expired for myself, for Mr. Robinette, and for Mr. Pinkerton. Those are your three executive contracts that you have with as a board with the district. And through the advice of of the district's attorney, we have revised those employment agreements, and they're here tonight for your consideration.
Thank you. Is there any public comment? Seeing none, we'll go to the board. Mr. Quessenberry.
I just want to clarify, perhaps for the public or the viewing audience, that all of these contracts are public information, and they are available on our website. So I just want to clarify that. And with that, I would move approval of the contracts.
So we have a motion by Mr. Quessenberry, a second by Mr. Unger. All in favor? Aye. Opposed? Passes 6-0. Okay, we're moving on to the action consent agenda. Please let me know if you would like anything pulled for discussion. Item 12.01, approval of certificated and classified personnel items. 12.02, ratify board's appointment of Julia Jones to the Personnel Commission. 12.03, approve minor revisions to the 2016-2017 instructional calendar. 12.04, adopt the board's interests for CSEA negotiations. 12.05, approve waiver request for educational interpreter certification requirement. 12.07, acceptance, 12.06, disposition of surplus property. 12.07, acceptance of donations. 12.08, approval of furniture and equipment requests. 12.09, approval of purchase orders. 12.10, approval of warrants and payroll.
I move approval of items 12.01 to 12.10.
We have a motion by Mr. Unger, second by Mrs. Sheffer. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Passes 6-0. Item 13.2, the advance agenda. Does anyone have anything that they would like to put forward as an advance agenda item? Seeing no one, we'll move on then. 14.1, the annual developer fee report.
Yeah, Ms. Rogers, given that this is a relatively new practice, we include under item 1401 and 1402 just information for the public for the purpose of transparency, but it's not meant necessarily for the board to have discussions over. It's just public access and for your information. So in this case, it's the annual developer fee report. And of course, that's tied to report out by board members too. So this 14.01 is just meant for public consumption, but not necessarily for board discourse.
Thank you. 14.02, reports by board members. Anyone have anything interesting, Mr. Unger?
Yeah, I got to visit Morro Bay High School last Thursday, and I just wanted to thank some teachers that welcomed me into their classrooms, and that would have been Megan Whiteson. She was doing home economics, and she was doing a CHOP challenge. It was great. I walked into the class, and it smelled so good. And what was really cool is half the class was guys, and everybody was engaged. It was really neat. Saw Mr. Rapucci. He was doing coding, as a matter of fact, Mr. Quisenberry. Peggy Flynn was doing biology. Katie Osborne was doing ceramics, and the ceramics was really neat. They were firing pots, and then they were literally melting horsehair over the pots to give them these great designs. It smelled really bad, but it was really pretty neat to see. Liz Moore, Andrew Silva was doing weight training, and just a big kind of a shout out to him. He was doing some really neat weight training stuff, and I noticed on the website that he also teaches yoga at the school. So it was really neat to see that. I went into Mr. Godsey's class. He was doing leadership, and Daniel Fay's class for AVID. So just some really cool stuff going on at Morro Bay High. And I was, with Dr. Prater, able to go to the band performance last night at the PAC. And, of course, Bryn Bellier put on a great performance, as did the kids. It was some really moving music. So, just a big hooray for Morro Bay High School.
Thank you. Anyone else? Mr. Buckman, and I need to ask you to move your microphone so that I'm able to see the light. There we go, because I don't want to miss you.
Thanks. I appreciate it. Just three quick things. First of all, I just want to send a sort of appreciation to the rest of the board and maybe a message to the public. We have been meeting a lot lately, and one of the times that we meet regularly, at least once a month now, is on Fridays from 9 until noon. And it's so impressive to me that the entire board shows up at those meetings on a Friday. And I just wanted to point that out and sort of thank everybody, thank all of us for being there. I did get to attend the CSBA conference with everybody. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to mention three of the workshops that I found really helpful and interesting. One was one on governance. The school board members in the audience were so excited that they were coming up, talking to the presenter, and then several filled out their slips and asked that this be taped because this was the second year that many of us had attended. I don't know whether I was texting Kimberly McGrath during the conference, but I attended a workshop on the tech internet information gap that's going on and the work that's being done up in Richmond, or I guess I'm supposed to say Contra Costa School District now, West Costa Costa, because you're not supposed to say Richmond, but they have been really trying to get the internet connection to everybody that they can, and they've discovered, and I'm probably going to get this a little technically wrong, but those little cameras that the police department and the city use to monitor cars going through intersections, those are all done via the internet, and they are working to figure out a way to use those to send a signal, Wi-Fi signal, to communities. So, that was my reaction, Marilyn. It was really cool. So I'm going like this to Kim. And then the last one was a parent involvement workshop that maybe I can share some of the stuff with you guys as it comes down to this LCAP discussion. And then third, I went into the Apple store today, and there are a group of students. They're wearing yellow Apple T-shirts. They're totally engaged in. They've taken up a whole table, totally engaged. And I'm going, oh God, please let this be a San Luis Coast. It's Mrs. Kirby from Monarch Grove, and we talked a little bit. The kids were working on the iPads and different Apple products, but the other half of the class was over at Woodstock's making pizza. And this was close to lunchtime, but I didn't get to eat any of it, but I thought that was great. And the parents had all gone to some fourth level of driving so that they could drive their students over there. And then just lastly, I was able to visit Monarch Grove with Catherine, Chris, and Marilyn, and Jim?
Yeah.
And Jim, who I just stole his thunder, I guess. But it was really good to be there with Marilyn and Jim because they have so much knowledge of what's going on the coast. So, but been busy.
Mr. Questenberry? Your light is not on. Well, then.
Can I add something real quick?
Sure.
I think we should. I think that we should recognize the members of our staff that participated in the CSBA conference.
You stole my thunder, Chris. Go ahead.
No, I'm not stealing your thunder.
No, you're already on it. You're on a roll. Go. Okay. Well, I was going to acknowledge the members of our staff who put on two seminars at CSBA, one on the STEAM education continuum. We had Andre Illig, principal at Los Osos Middle School, and Dr. Kyle Pruitt, principal at Morro Bay High School, and Kimberly McGrath presenting on STEAM, and it was well attended and really well done. I felt very proud of our presenting group and of our district. And then we had a second presentation on the standards-based report card where we had Amy Shields, Darla Batistic, and we had a couple of board members. Well, we had a couple of board members in both presentations. And that was also well attended and well presented. And so I think we were there, you know, to support our own staff and the work that they've done, but also it was interesting and informative for me, and I think it was for my fellow board members also. So thank you for putting in all that work and for going to San Diego and presenting to a statewide audience.
And least but not last, it was. A, there was a lot of presence by San Luis Coastal up there, two presentations. But sort of the highlight for me was watching Chris Unger become the state president of the California School Boards Association after years of work making the organization better, and lots of time on his part, and then standing in front of I don't know how many thousands of people. But for me, one of the best parts was when Chris got down off and he'd given his acceptance speech, I guess, and was mobbed by the students that were at this delegation. And just, it was like instant rock and roll stardom. But congratulations, Chris.
He has been forbidden to wear his crown at our local board meeting. So, given that we've done our board reports, we have no additional business. We will then stand adjourned until January 12th.